Okay, so we are on chapter 3, verse 22. If you recall, let me just bring you back up to date if you were not here last time. Abner was the head of the troops of Ish-bosheth, Saul's son, who was king in the north, as David was king in the south. There's a civil, essentially a civil war going on. And Abner, because of a fight over a concubine, defects from Ish-bosheth and goes south to be with David. In the process, though, before that, he found himself killing Joab, who's David's commander. David is Joab to David as Abner to Ish-bosheth. Abner had to kill Joab's brother, who was chasing after him. He really had no choice. So he defects to David. But we know that David's commander feels a sort of murderous rage towards him, okay? So he comes to David and he says, I'm leaving Ish-bosheth, essentially. I want to align with you. I can bring you the northern tribes. David says, as a sign of good faith, bring me back Michal, who was Saul's daughter that was married to David a long time ago, though Saul has long since married her off to someone else. Abner says, fine. Brings him Michal, whose current husband, Paltiel, follows her weeping all the way until Abner says to him, go back, and he leaves. okay, so, verse 22. And look, David's servants and Joab had come from a raid, and abundant booty they brought with them, and Abner was not with David in Hebron, for he had sent him off, and he went in peace. So just because these are the kinds of sentences that we tend to glide over, in other words, David's troops are still going on raids, presumably in not Israelite territory, although it doesn't say. It could be against the north, against the Israelites. It could be against the Philistines. We don't know. But they're going on raids and carrying back the spoils of war. We're talking about a very different civilization from anything we know. That's how they feed the army. That's why people join the army, because they know they're going to get to raid other towns, kill people, and take their stuff. It's true. When you see, for example, in modern armies, like the other day in the New York Times, when it talked about all that art that was looted by the Nazis that they just discovered, this is not a new thing. It's not a new thing. I mean, that's what people do, unfortunately. And Joab and all the force that was with him had come, and they told Joab, saying, Abner, son of Ner, has come to the king, and sent him off, and he went in peace. So Joab now knows that Ish-bosheth's commander has defected to David, and David was okay with it and didn't send him off, didn't hurt him, didn't capture him, didn't anything. And you can imagine how Joab feels about that, because Abner is a double threat to him. One, he killed his brother. So, and it doesn't matter that it was his brother's fault. That's irrelevant. Blood is thicker than water. If you kill my brother, then I have to get you back. Remember that, and I'll come back to that in one second. The second thing is, if Abner comes to David, Abner's job is a commander, and that's Joab's job. So why is Abner coming to David? Obviously, there's going to be some professional rivalry as well as personal rivalry. We've mentioned this before, but it's worth reminding ourselves. One of the great advances of civilization, and I'm not being facetious about this, was people giving up the right to personal revenge in favor of society doing it through courts and jails and so on. Because the natural instinct is, you kill my brother, I kill you, or I kill your brother, or something like that. It's like mafia justice, right? That's how people naturally work. And in order to give that up, you also have to take the possibility that you won't actually get the revenge that you want, because the person may go through the court system and be found innocent. And so that was a huge advance, and still, it hasn't conquered the whole world. But to set up a system of courts so that people don't take personal revenge, that was the only thing that allows a sort of organized society to work, and also allows the society control over things like not only revenge, but what you don't have here, which is over the military. Civilian control over the military doesn't allow people to raid and loot and so on. In militaristic societies where the generals call the shots, the troops get to do what they want. So what you're seeing here is before all these advances happened, right? David would not dare say to his troops, you can't raid. And as upset as he might be at Yoav, he doesn't have another system for Yoav to exercise his grievance other than to go kill Abner. I mean, there's nothing else. It's not like you're going to bring Abner before a trial and put him in jail or decide that it was, you know. Remember that in the Torah, if somebody commits involuntary manslaughter, that they go to a city of refuge. And the reason that they set up cities of refuge was that that was a place where you couldn't take individual revenge, right? People who were members of the family were not allowed in that city. And it was only when the high priest would die that they were allowed out back out again, and there would be a general sort of amnesty. And then if you killed them, it was murder. But that's the reason you had to set up those cities of refuge, was that you didn't have an organized means of preventing people from taking revenge. So you actually had to set up places where the vengeful people were not allowed to get there. Okay, so all of that is background to the fact that Yoav is not happy. And Yoav came to the king and said, what have you done? By the way, you can also imagine, which makes sense, that Yoav assumes Abner's bad will, right? He's got to assume that Abner is down there to cause mischief, not that he's really defected to David, but he's a spy for Ishbosheth, you know, because that whole story about a concubine is pretty thin gruel, you know, that's why he defected. Okay. Look, Abner has come to you. Why did you send him off? And he went going off. You know that Abner, son of Ner, to dupe you has come. That's kind of strange. I'm sure that this is not the... Don't you know that Abner has come only to deceive you? The JPS translation reads more fluently there. To dupe you has come is not, you know... Right, and to learn your comings and goings and to learn all that you do. Now, that's perfectly reasonable to think that. I think that is probably what we would assume, right? I mean, you know what kind, when a Russian would defect to the United States, the CIA would put them through all sorts of grueling tests of different kinds to try to figure out whether they were genuine, and even then, who knows? Even then, you can't really tell. And Yoav went out from David's presence. That's important. He doesn't say, I'm going to do anything, and David doesn't say, do anything. But he goes out from David's presence and sent messengers after Abner. And they brought him back from the cistern of Sirah. Now, those kinds of little touches are so great because it means that whoever wrote this thought that their audience would know where that is. So you know that it wasn't written 1,000 years later, because the cistern of Sirah has long since passed into the collective oblivion of most of human history. But obviously, it was close enough to the time that everybody knew the landmark. So it's like my saying, you know, he went to Milwaukee, and you would know. But in a couple thousand years, it is possible that Milwaukee won't be. And David didn't know. So Yoav is doing this by himself. And why does the text say David didn't know? There are two reasons. One possibility is David didn't know. Okay, but the other possibility, which is equally plausible in some way, is what's about to happen to Abner? He's going to get killed, right? Yoav is going to kill him. So it is another in the endless series of people who are inconvenient to David who die without any responsibility being assigned to David, right? I mean, don't forget that Abner, good, bad, or indifferent, Abner was the commander of the forces that opposed David. You can't imagine that David's going to be that upset that Abner dies, because David can't necessarily trust him either. David doesn't know for sure that he's defecting. So if he dies and David is not responsible, then, as you'll see, David will react the same way that he has in past instances. In fact, he even says so, as you'll see in a moment. And Avner came back to Hebron. Now, why Avner comes back when Yoav calls him? This maybe lets you know that Avner wasn't actually the best commander for David, because he's not cunning enough to... In fact, he's a little bit idealistic, Avner. Remember how he tries to avoid killing Asahel, who keeps running after him, and he says, don't run after me, I'm going to have to kill you. And Asahel runs after him, and he kills him. And then it's Avner's speech that ends the fighting back and forth, right? Avner says, must the sword devour forever? Stop this. It's enough death already. Yoav never says it's enough death. Yoav, that's his, you know, that's who he is. Yoav is the biblical equivalent of a street fighter. He does not think that, you know. So Avner came back to Hebron, and Yoav drew him aside into the gate to speak with him deceptively. Now, why would he get that close? Again, Avner's got to be less conscienceless than Yoav is. And he struck him there in the belly, and he died for the blood of Asahel, Yoav's brother. So Yoav kills him because he killed his brother. And David heard afterward and said, innocent am I. Right? First thing he says, I didn't know, I wasn't there, it wasn't me. And my kingship, in other words, it's not just me, but by extension, my rule is innocent of this atrocity. Before the Lord for all time of the blood of Avner, son of Ner. May the blood guilt come down on the head of Yoav and all his father's house, that is, his brothers as well, and may there never lack in the house of Yoav a sufferer of discharge from his member. Whoa. Yes, you think that it's only the Yiddish that that have curses like that. And running sores on his skin, and a man clutching a woman's spindle, and one falling by the sword, and one wanting for bread. Which is a pretty comprehensive, in other words, the part of them that is masculine should suffer, and they should be feminized, right? A woman, a man at the spindle is, in other words, they shouldn't even be men. When they're men, they should suffer from the source of their manhood, and they should all, you know, forever and ever go hungry. Which, by the way, in the ancient world is the most... It's in some ways the most common curse, because for most of human history, most people spent most of their time searching for food. That's just what they did. I mean, it's an extraordinary liberation from the great plague of human history for us to know that one thing we won't suffer from is a lack of food. I mean, obviously, you can tell by our eating mechanisms that, in fact, to stuff yourself when food is available is somehow built into us, because food was often not available. And it's not only that, but if you ever read accounts of hunger, it completely takes you over, right? It's comprehensive in its psychological and physiological, in the devastation of its effects. So by one wanting for bread, he's giving him a sort of comprehensive curse for him and for his family. And he does this for, I mean, there are probably multiple reasons, but one is, of course, to emphasize how much he is innocent. That is, not only am I innocent, but I'm cursing Yoav forever. And you will see when we get to the end of the book that one of his last instructions to Solomon is, make sure you kill Yoav, right? I hate to give away the ending, but that's what as David is dying, David's final instructions to Solomon are basically who to kill and who to save. And Yoav is on the kill list. And in fact, Solomon does kill Yoav. And David says, because of what he did, this is the sin that he points to, because he struck down Avner, son of Ner, in cold blood. And the curse. So David really means what he says. But so you might argue, and it's possible that, and we'll come to this when we come to it, but since I've already mentioned it, it's possible that he does it because he genuinely didn't want him to kill Avner, and he really thought Avner would bring him the northern tribes, and he was very upset that Yoav foreclosed that possibility. That is certainly possible. The alternate reading is that he was glad Yoav did it. He couldn't be publicly glad Yoav did it because he'd offend everybody in the north. He had to be upset with him. But then he knew when Solomon became king, since Yoav, by the way, supports Solomon's brother, Adoniah, he doesn't support Solomon. So David knows when Solomon becomes king that Yoav is a deadly adversary. And he wants to give advice to his son, this is the guy you got to eliminate because he's going to cause you trouble in ways you can't imagine. Believe me, I know Yoav. We had our whole lives together. Kill him. And Solomon does. So it's very difficult to know, and it's not, and most people don't work, most people don't do almost anything significant in their lives from one motivation alone. So it's not to say that David had one motivation and not the other. And also, we would like to think that David just abhors useless death. Because it's not like David hasn't killed people, but that doesn't mean that he thinks killing is morally neutral or good. And Yoav and Abishai, his brother, had lain in wait for Abner because he put to death Asahel, their brother, in Gibeon in the battle. Now, why it is that it repeats had lain in wait or had killed is another reading, Abner, when we already know that and we already know why he did it, is not entirely clear, but maybe it's just reminding you after David's curse that David had a good reason to curse him, that it was premeditated murder, because Abner obviously didn't, and that's why it says in the battle, that he kills Asahel in the battle. It's not murder if you kill someone in the battle, it's murder if you wait for them by the gate and stab them in the belly. And David said to Yoav and to all the troops who were with him, tear your garments and gird on sackcloth and keen, that is mourn for Abner. So this, I think this verse tells you several things at once. First of all, it's David is never just talking to Yoav. Remember, David may be king, but Yoav is the general, which means that the troops, it says Yoav and the troops who were with him meaning with Yoav. So you say to yourself, why doesn't David just get rid of Yoav? Because not only is he an effective general, but the troops have loyalty to him. I mean, the troops like, in quotes, the bloodthirsty general who they know is going to protect them and lead them effectively into battle. And remember, just before, what did Yoav do? He led them on a raid and brought back all these spoils. They don't want David to get rid of Yoav. He feeds their families, basically. So David has to be very careful and politic about how he handles this. He can curse Yoav. He can publicly humiliate Yoav, which is what he's doing. You killed Abner, now mourn for him publicly, which is a humiliation for Yoav, that he has to mourn for the guy who killed his brother, right? Just imagine that you have to publicly mourn for the guy who killed your brother, whom you just killed. But he can't get rid of him. He needs Yoav too badly to get rid of him, right? So, guys, please, thank you. And David said to Yoav and to all the troops who were with him, tear your garments, which is, as you know, the ancient sign of mourning, gird on sackcloth, mourn for Abner, and King David was walking behind the bier. So David publicly mourns as well, right? And for the king to walk behind your coffin is an honor and so on. And they buried Abner in Hebron, and the king raised his voice and wept over the grave of Abner, and all the people wept. Now, maybe it's a little overdone. I mean, why does David weep for Abner? We'll come to his lament in a second, but you can read this as David's remarkable ability to publicly convey whatever emotion is required at the time. So he dances with the ark, which we haven't gotten to yet, but he will. He publicly mourns for Jonathan and Saul. He publicly weeps for Abner, who he really has no reason to weep for. I mean, it's not like they were buddies. Avner came and met with him and said, I'm going to defect to you, but even so. But he gives a very, very convincing, genuine or not genuine, and I'm going to, you can always make your own decision, but he gives a very convincing performance of being angry at Yoav, cursing Yoav, making Yoav mourn, crying for Avner, and now publicly composing a lament for Avner. And the king lamented over Avner and said, like the death of the base should Avner have died, your hands never bound, your feet never placed in fetters, as one before scoundrels you fell. In other words, you weren't captured, you weren't punished, you were just murdered in cold blood. And all the people continued to weep over him. And again, this sounds strange to us, but you know there is ritualistic weeping. Like if you go to funerals in traditional societies, you'll hear and see women keening and weeping for people they barely know. But that's what you're supposed to do. And it's not inauthentic, it's real. It's just a different way of expressing public grief. As opposed to saying, oh, that's terrible, I'm so sorry to hear that, and turning the page, right? Which is what we do. Remember that, among other things, the death of a major public figure is a rare thing in the ancient world. And also, you've got to figure that at least some of these people were people from the north who actually did know Avner. Since he was a commander, that means he had a fairly exalted position. So presumably some of them were genuinely upset. And all the people came to give David bread to eat while it was still day. And David swore, saying, thus and more may God do to me if before the sun sets I taste bread or anything at all. Now, the thus and more in Hebrew is ko ya'aseli Elohim. This may God do to me. Now, why doesn't he say what God should do to him? Because words in Hebrew have power. And you do not curse yourself in Hebrew, right? So you say, may God do this to me, but you don't specify, because that is what is called in rabbinic literature, pitchon peh lesatan, opening mouth for Satan. In other words, allowing the evil, you're giving the evil an opportunity by saying, why don't you do this to me, God, and then God's going to go and do that to you. And even people who are not superstitious are reluctant to say what terrible things should happen to them if they don't. I mean, we feel that power of words, and that's why in Hebrew, as I mentioned before, cursing is called Lashon Sagi Nahor, which means the language of sufficient light. That's actually Aramaic, but the language of sufficient light, because you don't call a blind man blind in the Talmud. You call him of sufficient light. In other words, the exact opposite of what he is. And sometimes in the commentaries, when you'll see why does God not destroy Israel, is what the commentator wants to say. When Israel sinned, why doesn't God destroy Israel? They won't say, why doesn't God destroy Israel? They'll say, so why doesn't God destroy the enemies of Israel? Even though you have to know, and you have to know rabbinic literature, and the context to know what they're saying is, why doesn't God destroy Israel? But no traditional commentator would say that, because that's pitchon peh lesatan. So here too, David just says, may God do this to me, instead of saying, you know, may God make my right hand wither, for example, which is an example where he does, and the psalmist does say that, right? If I forget Jerusalem, may my right hand wither. But that's a rare thing. Usually you'll just say, you know, may God do whatever it is that God will do to me. All of this not wanting to lose the fact that David is now starving himself too. Well, fasting for a day anyway. And all the people took note, and it was good in their eyes. They approved of this. This is how a king ought to act when somebody is publicly murdered. And all that the king had done was good in the eyes of the people. So David again shows his remarkable ability to understand how Israel works, and to play his part to perfection, which is not to say that it's not genuine, but even, especially if it's genuine, it's that much more remarkable. Because what it says is that David has the perfect instincts for, he's what you would call a natural politician, okay? I mean, just like the politician who loves to dive into the crowd and shake everyone's hand, And if it was really artificial, you would feel it. You would say, like, okay, this guy's shaking my hand, but he doesn't really want to, right? He really, you know, wants to be on the golf course and not with me. David, in the ancient world, they had the same receptors of authenticity that we do. So presumably, if David didn't have some authentic feeling, both for Avner and for the sadness of the occasion and so on, it wouldn't be good in the eyes of the people, one assumes. And all the people and all Israel knew on that day that it had not been from the king to put to death Avner, son of Ner, which was all David wants, right? He wants them to know that it's not from him. Now, I just want to say, I mean, even though I always give you both interpretations, the truth is it is impossible to know, and the only witness that we have says that it wasn't from him. So on balance, you know, even though we moderns like to read what the text doesn't say, on balance, you've got to assume that since that's the only witness and it was written around that time and David continues to be king, it might very well be that David really did not want Yoav to do that. And even though it's more fun to play with the cynical interpretation, to be fair, you know, the story, the only person who actually knew was David, and the only testimony we have about how people judged it is that they judged that he was being authentic. So I don't want to overplay, although it does happen an awful lot to him. And the king said to his servants, "You must know that a commander and a great man has fallen this day in Israel, and I am gentle and just anointed king, and these sons of Zeruiah are too hard for me." Those sons being Yoav, Avishai, and Asahel, right? Those are the boys that Zeruiah raised, and they're, you know, "May the Lord pay back the evildoer according to his evil." The thing that is, I mean, and Alter notes this too, the thing that's worth our remembering is that David let's take David at his word and say, although remember that this is David who led raids in the Philistine towns, so he's not that gentle, and killed men, women, and children, which is by the testimony of the text. That's not something we have to make up. So he's not that gentle. But nonetheless, there are still degrees of bloodthirstiness, and Yoav is bloodthirstier than David, but David doesn't get rid of him. He doesn't get rid of him because, you know, it reminds me, I don't know if I've told you this story before, lahavdil elef havdalot, as they say in Hebrew, which is, lahavdil means like when you compare two things that you want to only compare those two things and everything else is different, you say lahavdil. Like if I say, you know, your mustache looks just like Hitler's, lahavdil. I'm saying, I'm not comparing you, I'm just saying that's exactly the same mustache, right? So I tried to, an example that would. So lahavdil elef havdalot means difference, 1,000 differences. Okay, I'm about to tell you a story that's very different, but it illustrates the same idea. So many years ago, when I was starting out at the UJ, there was an elderly philanthropist in Los Angeles with whom I used to periodically have lunch because he wanted a connection with what's now American Jewish University, then was the UJ. So once every month or 2 months we would have lunch and he would tell me the stories of, you know, Los Angeles and how it grew and what he saw. Anyway, so one day he said to me, let's say his name was, I don't know, pick, let's say his name was David. It wasn't David, but so. So one day he said to me, you know, he said, the people in my work, they call me David the Softy. You know why? He says, because when I need to fire someone from my job, I look at them and I can't. He says, I think the guy has a wife, the guy has kids, he has to support people. He goes, so I get someone else to fire them. Just like that. And I was sitting there, I thought, did you hear what you just said? I never forgot it. He says, so they call me David the Softy. And I'm thinking, really? I can think of another. But so David has the same dilemma. If David is gentle, in fact, and he might well be, the truth is you can't be king in the ancient world without somebody to do your dirty work. He has to have somebody who will fire the people, although in this world it's not fire, but somebody who has to fire the people, so he can't get rid of Yoav, even if he really disapproves of Yoav's moral code, because there's going to be war, and remember, Abner aside, he's still in the middle of a civil war with Ishbosheth. It's not over. Just because Abner defects doesn't mean that Ishbosheth is all done. So for all those reasons, David can't just say, you know, Yoav is no longer my commander and I'm going to get rid of him, and in fact never ever does. Yoav stays as David's commander until, until Solomon succeeds him, which is another remarkable thing about Yoav and lets you know how, in some ways, I mean, really, it's a shame that we don't have a book about Yoav, because here's the guy who's, no, I mean of the contemporary book that actually talks about who Yoav was, the way that we have about David, because here's Yoav who is the commander of the troops, is in the front of the fighting in a lifetime filled with fighting, and yet survives it all until Solomon decides to put him to death. You know, in the same way that it's astonishing that David dies in his bed after all of this. So, okay. Questions, comments? Yeah. Unless Ishbosheth sent him. That's the only question. Yeah. Is he a spy or is he a defector? And that's, you know, obviously Yoav has suspicions. It serves Yoav's purpose anyway because he wants to kill him. But Yoav has suspicions, but it's just impossible to know. But yeah, I think on balance, it's likely that David thought that Abner was useful. Because you got also, the one other thing which I didn't say before and I should have, is that there's reason to think that Abner is a defector. And the reason to think that he's a defector is the North is losing. And we're told that the North is losing. So you're going to get genuine defectors when the ship is going down anyway. So that may be why David is genuinely upset. Because he figures, I'm winning the war, that's why I'm getting the general from the North. This concubine stuff is ridiculous. It's all about, you know, it's all about who's winning. So.
And I wonder if the story about Asahel is a popular one. That seems a little, you know, a little strange. And then it's repeated a few times. So.
It does. It does seem strange. I mean, let me put it this way. It's not strange that Abner kills Yoav's brother. The way that it happens is strange. That he runs after him. He tells him, don't run after me. He keeps running after him. So finally he kills him. That's strange, although it does, I mean, look, by all accounts, it's too late to do DNA testing or other kinds of testing, but the sons of Zuria suffer from an overdose of testosterone, it seems. So it's not, Asahel is not the kind of, you know, you would expect them to keep running when people tell them to stop. They probably, you know, they were probably diagnosed ADD when they were in preschool. They were the kids who could not sit still. But they, in that society, it actually proves to be a useful, you know. That's another thing, is that what we think of as, you know, maladaptive behavior in the ancient world actually fit very well. You want kids who run around too much because they're going to grow up to be good soldiers. I assume that it's very likely that David didn't want Abner killed, but you can't be entirely sure, and it doesn't completely hurt him. In fact, it probably raises him in the eyes of the people, the way that he then mourns for Abner. So, yeah.
But wouldn't Yoav have lost face if he didn't kill Abner?
Yes, I think that's why he did.
Right.
From Yoav's point of view, he had no choice. Here's the commander of the troops of Israel. His brother is killed by the enemy commander. If he doesn't do anything, yeah, I actually think that everybody in this story is trapped in a way, I haven't thought about it before, but that's an interesting way of thinking about it, which is Abner is trapped because Asahel doesn't give him a choice. If he doesn't kill him, he's going to kill Abner. That's clear. Yoav is trapped because once Abner kills his brother, he's got to take revenge. David is trapped because he can't get rid of Yoav, but he can't save Abner. I mean, you can't, are you going to monitor Yoav 24 hours a day? There's nothing to do. So everybody plays their parts. It's almost like a jigsaw puzzle, and it comes out the way it has to come out. Yeah. I'll keep going across. Yeah. No, they weren't on opposite sides. Yoav Avishai and Asahel are all on the same on this side. Avner is over here, right? Yoav's brother Asahel goes and tries to kill Avner. Avner kills him. So you've got two brothers now. Later, Yoav goes and kills Avner. That's how it works. Yeah. No. Yes, Chronicles. Divrei HaYamim. The Book of Chronicles is basically the same story, but it actually whitewashes David even more. It's like, we don't know for sure, but it was clearly written after Samuel. So for example, when David takes a census in the Book of Samuel, and which we haven't gotten to, David takes a census and then is punished. In Chronicles, it says that Satan incited David, the first mention of that kind of satan. So that's how we know it's so late, because the introduction of Satan as someone that incites human beings is very late in Jewish literature before the Talmud. It says Satan incited David to do it. It's like it wasn't even David's fault. So Chronicles basically takes the Shmuel story and makes it less interesting and whitewashes David more, but it doesn't contradict it in any significant way. So
but there is no other evidence or
nothing. This is it. That's why there was a debate about whether David existed or not for a long time. And really, it wasn't really put to rest until they found the inscription that said Beit David from 200 years, the house of David, from 200 years after David died, is the inscription. And people said, look, you don't say the house of David 200 years later from somebody who didn't exist in an ancient society where 200 years, the memory of 200 years is very present, right? So we don't know about the story of David, but that there was a David, I don't think any serious biblical scholar anymore doubts it, even though there are some who like to, but I don't think there's any room to doubt it. Yeah. The only things you can rely on are other societies around that time, so that you see, does this fit in to what was happening at that time, and other literature from that society of around that time. Whatever archaeology can give you, like what did the houses look like, did we find, there's a big argument about whether they found David's palace or not. And nobody knows for sure, but that's a continuing archaeological argument at the moment. And also the sort of the evidence underneath the scripture from the scripture, that is reading it against its own, trying to read it in a way that it will yield things that it doesn't intend to. In the same way that you have a conversation with someone and they tell you things that they don't mean to tell you, the same thing with the, but that's it. Yeah.
Can I ask a question about the speaker we had on Tuesday?
Sure. No, he didn't say that. He didn't say there'll be peace. No. He said building settlements clearly impairs the Israeli relationship with the United States. At a time when you need the United States desperately and you need to be close and you have a much bigger agenda like Iran, Netanyahu wants everything. He wants the settlements and he wants the close relationship with the United States so that they'll do what he wants with Iran. He said, you can't have international diplomacy that way. You have to be able to give up something in order to build alliances with people whom you need. That's what he said. He didn't say if you give up the settlement, you'll have peace. Yeah.
What's Yoav's motivation to stay loyal to David? He's publicly humiliated him, not just with the cursing, but then at the end, he says they're savage and they're wicked. And, you know, so it's one thing to sort of say, okay, he sort of had to
right.
do that for his own purpose, but then he goes on and on about it.
So I don't know. I mean, I can only speculate. Why does Yoav stay loyal to David? So here are several different possibilities, but I'm reading into a motivation of somebody that none of us know. One is David's the guy. He's just the guy. And all of Israel knows he's the guy, and he was from the time he was a kid. So Yoav has been fortunate enough to hitch his wagon to the star, and he's not going to let something like a little public humiliation ruin his career, because he's still the number one guy to the star, even if the star occasionally, humiliates him. The second is that Yoav might, he might feel, and I don't know how far he goes, he might feel like, okay, this is the way the game is played. This is the price I have to pay for taking the revenge I have to take, and everybody around understands it. They know the humiliation would have been much greater if I hadn't killed him, and that this is the humiliation that Yoav has to go through because he killed him. That's possible too. And then the third possibility, which I think is the least likely, but it's, is maybe Yoav and David had this understanding all along. You got to kill him, go kill him. I want you to know after you kill him, I'm going to have to do X, Y, and Z. That's the price you're going to have to pay. Yoav goes, of course, I understand, and I'll, you know, and I'll do this, and my troops will do that, and then we'll be done with it. I don't know. But I think probably the greatest motivation is, you know, you can back the second candidate who's not going to win, but once you're separate from David, you know, most of the people love David. They don't love Yoav. The troops may love Yoav, but the people love David, so,
yeah.
He could, but I mean, it's also possible. I mean, I have no idea that how self-reflective Yoav was. He might know that he's not a king. He's a warrior. So that's possible, too. I don't know. Yeah.
Well, first of all, I'd like to apologize.
Oh, no. Don't worry about it.
Being discourteous.
Don't worry. It doesn't. Nothing. It says nothing at all.
So,
except that they approved of David.
Right.
So
they
when.
Don't know what their reaction was towards Yoav. Will the troops still follow him? Will the people.
They still follow him.
And say, hey, you got
nope.
To get rid of this guy?
Nope. Not at all. I think that as long as David seems to be an effective ruler and is taking the right public stances, what you raise actually in an interesting way is another answer to Roberta's question, which is it's possible that by doing this, David saves Yoav. Maybe the people would have been upset, but once Yoav is humiliated, so everything then order is restored. You know, maybe they would say, we don't want somebody going around killing people randomly. And David says, I understand that. So now he's going to have to mourn and he's going to have to be humiliated and I curse his house and now we're good. So maybe it actually is to Yoav's advantage to restore order that way. Yeah.
I'm looking for a timeline in my head. So the fair lad, David, takes on Goliath. Time goes on. And I can't picture how much time when David becomes king versus this guy, Yoav, who must be much older than David.
Doesn't have to be older. They grew up together, basically. I think they're probably contemporaries. But how old is David now? Is that what you're asking? Well, he rules for 40 years, we know is a symbolic number, but still, David's probably now, since he's still at the beginning of his rule, he's probably in his early 30s to mid 30s. Remember that in the ancient world, if you lived past, I think it was 20 or something like that, then your average lifespan was in the 60s. You know, that's the reason that the average lifespan is so low is because there was so much infant and teenage mortality. But if you lived, you know, if you got past, now that doesn't mean you didn't live the way we do. That is, you know, dental care was very poor. In fact, I've read people say that more human misery has been caused by a toothache than by almost anything else. If you think about it, seriously, if you think about it, that's, if you don't have a cure for that, it doesn't stop hurting, right? If you have an abscess or if you have decay or whatever, it doesn't stop hurting. It's going to basically hurt you forever and ever till the tooth falls out and then the next one starts to hurt. So life was a less pleasant, but it could be just as long. Yeah.
I hope you can clarify something. Without the court historian, would we even know that David existed?
Well, if we found that inscription, we would. But we wouldn't know what David was. Instead of saying the court historian, without the Bible, without the books that were written by whomever they were written, would we know? No, any more than we know. Without a written chronicle, we don't know of civilizations in general. I mean, how do we know about the Mayans? They didn't leave any written chronicles of what they did. We know them by their buildings, basically, and we extrapolate from that. But without inscriptions, and there weren't very many stone inscriptions in Israel, without inscriptions or some kind of written record, no.
In Kirsch's book later on,
yeah,
he points out that David created a very complicated infrastructure.
As based on the Bible, right.
That's, again, that's the story.
It's based on the Bible, yep. We don't know what the infrastructure is. I mean, we found, again, as I said, we have this palace. We don't know. Nobody knows how big or small David's kingdom was. One of the things that goes back to the question that's being asked is no source so far outside of Israel mentions David or Solomon, for that matter. No source outside of Israel. They mention Omri, another king later, but they don't mention David or Solomon. That's one of the reasons why skeptics started to doubt whether David or Solomon existed. If this was such a huge kingdom, how come nobody mentions them? Although, again, tomorrow, you know, you could have a headline found somewhere in, you know, and that's one of the reasons why, I mean, there are lots of other reasons, but one of the reasons why war in the Middle East is so sad, and like things that are happening in Syria or Iraq are so sad, because who knows what, if, you know, if we could excavate there, and who knows what's been destroyed or what we don't have, or, yeah. In Israel, in Beit Sha'an, I think. I don't remember, but I'm gonna have to look it up. No, in the ground. No, it was dug up. It was dug up as a fragment.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
What's the mechanics of revenge? Like, let's say if Abner had a brother who was supposed to kill Avram, I mean, how far does it go? Just keep killing him.
Yes, basically. I mean, if Abner had a brother, he would probably go after Yoav. Yeah. I don't know. I assume that until the families make some kind of pact, that it doesn't necessarily stop. And it also probably depends on the disposition and the circumstances. I don't know if there's like a form particularly that, you know, okay, three generations and we're done or something like that. Seriously. But because in the American West, there were, you know, famously the Hatfields and the McCoys. And the revenge went on for generations, really for generations. So... I think that was that also may be a motivation of all this is we're done now. I've humiliated him. He's been punished, so don't come after him. Maybe, again, in that sense, maybe it's protective both of David's kingdom and of Yoav so that nobody will come after him. It satisfies the honor of Abner's family that the king mourns for him. Maybe.
I know that women usually don't do anything, but do they ever revenge? Do they ever participate in
revenge? Well, revenge, I don't know. I mean, the women do. Yael, remember, kills Sisera, who is, and the book of Judith, Judith also takes revenge. There are women who succeed in killing the enemy general, in a couple of instances. But in terms of revenge, I can't think offhand of an example. That doesn't mean there isn't one. I can't think of one offhand. So, yeah. So okay. So it's a wonderful point. That it's interesting to see when David speaks and when he doesn't speak. There's something weirdly passive about David sometimes. And that's true throughout his kingship. David, you know, sometimes David is just reactive to what happens around him. And Yoav is sort of the active principal. This certainly happens at the end of his life when he doesn't seem to be very active in succession, but it happens other times too. And it is certainly true. I don't know if... I mean, I understand why you're upset at David, because here's Yoav, who's been so vigorous in his defense, and later on will even murder Uriah on David's behalf when David gets in trouble with Bathsheba. It's a euphemism. So I can understand why you would be upset that David humiliates Yoav publicly, unless this was their spoken or unspoken agreement. That's the only way to sort of exonerate David from this. That is, he says to Yoav, look, I understand you had to do this, but we're going to just invite terrible, you know. Sometimes you don't do things because you know that if you do that, I'll give you an example. I'll turn this off and give you an example. Yes, Roberta.
Well,
could very well be. One of the questions, one of the interesting questions that we'll come to at the end is, did Yoav, did anyone know that David supported Solomon? Did David in fact support Solomon? Because what happens is that Bathsheba and Nathan come in and say, don't you remember how you promised that Solomon would be king? Well, we don't know anything about such a promise, but maybe he did, or maybe he didn't. Maybe Yoav thought Adoniah was the better king, and then all of a sudden he finds out that David supported Solomon and he's up the creek. I don't know. But you certainly, Yoav has reason to resent David, but having said that, they have a very successful partnership, and you've got to assume that we have incidents from their lives, but considering how long they spent together, a lot of other stuff must have gone on with David and Solomon, with David and Yoav, that we know nothing about. So these relationships are very complex. I mean, just think of any major relationship in your life, work or personal, could the story of that relationship be told in 5 or 6 incidents? Probably not. So who knows what else Yoav and David shared. Okay, last question, and then we've got a... No, that's actually, that. There we're actually asking God to destroy our enemies. Like every rule, it has lots of exceptions, but no, the point is about cursing yourself. There, when you do Shvoch HaMatcha, which is the, when you open the door and say, pour out your wrath, that was really an expression, I think, largely of the fact that Passover was always a terrible time for the Jews, a terrible time, when there were all sorts of persecutions, when Jews were accused of baking, you know, blood in matzah and just all sorts of absurd but incredibly destructive things. And so that was sort of an expression of their collective rage at what was being done in the hope that God would avenge them. So it makes people uncomfortable these days, but I have to say, it doesn't bother me a bit. I open the door and say it like with great, I almost feel like it's a tribute to the pain and rage of our ancestors that I don't pretend that such feelings didn't exist, you know, in our tradition, just because I'm lucky enough to live in a world in which I don't have to worry about somebody rushing in my door, you know, and taking my family. So, all right, and on that note,